Sunil Amrith is the Renu and Anant Dhawan Professor of History and Professor in the School of the Environment at Yale University. He's the author of 4 books and a recipient of multiple awards, including a MacArthur Genius Fellowship. His latest book is called The Burning Earth, An Environmental History of the Last 500 Years. Professor Amrith, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, I've had many historians on the podcast, and the topics varied from the Black Death to Hitler's underwear moment, crisis, whatever. But up until I saw an interview with you, I actually had no idea that such a thing as environmental history even existed, which probably says a lot about my or our detachment from nature. But we'll get to that a bit later on. Now, interestingly enough, you don't begin the story of how humans began impacting or transforming the environment with the advent of agriculture in what was it, 10,000 BCE, Mesopotamia, something like that? I hope I'm not way off. But rather, you begin in China about 1,000 years ago. Why is that?
I think you're absolutely right that I could have started the story much earlier. And in a way, I start the Burning Earth mid-flow, so to speak. And partly I wanted to do that because, as you'll have seen, the majority of the Burning Earth is really quite a modern history. And so in terms of how much to stretch the story, I thought what I would do is I would start with what I see as a major point of acceleration and inflection within this much longer history. And we can indeed take this back to the dawn of settled agriculture, as does my late great colleague Jim Scott in his wonderful book Against the Grain, which really does sort of tell that much, much longer history of humans on Earth. But I think starting in China 1,000 years ago makes sense for the story I want to tell, because what happens then is that this one strain of rice, what we now know as champa rice, which came from central Vietnam, allows a doubling of the acreage of land under rice in southern China within just a few decades. And this transforms how much human life can be sustained in concentration. And over the course of a couple of centuries after that innovation, China experiences significant population growth. That population growth is, I think, of world historical significance, because it's what allows China to really sort of emerge as the center of the global economy. And it was that wealth, of course, which, you know, led the Europeans from the far fringes of Eurasia on their ocean voyages in the first place. So I do see that as a sort of particularly important moment of not fundamental change, but of acceleration.
So what happens when this particular strain of rice makes it into China 1,000 years ago? Why is that particular strain of rice and not some other strain of rice which causes this massive spurt of growth?
There's two parts to that answer. One is that particular strain of rice is fast ripening. And it is very likely, we don't have all of the details, but it's very likely to have been cultivated and bred in an artisanal way by farmers, you know, bit by bit. And its initial arrival in China was very likely informal along the trading routes across the South China Sea, moving from farm to farm by word of mouth. But the pivotal transformation comes when the Chinese Empire, the emperor, orders 30,000 bushels of this seed and then actually instructs local officials to distribute it. An early version of agricultural extension officers. And this is being distributed with intention and with information. You start to get these elaborate agricultural manuals, for example, around that time, which instruct farmers on how to use this seed. And so it could have been other strains of rice. I think there is always an element of contingency to this, but the particular properties of this strain, together with the fact that this becomes a matter of imperial policy, is what I think comes together to facilitate that massive expansion. And that expansion, of course, is not without its losers as well as its winners. Indigenous groups in southern China are being displaced by the arrival of settled farmers. Many of them are migrants from further north. There is large-scale deforestation, which allows for the planting of the fields. And the new strain is also hardier, so it can be cultivated in areas which would previously have been seen as unsuitable for rice, particularly hillsides. And that's when you start to get these terraces, which we so associate now with rice agriculture.
Okay, but that sounds like a quite a dramatic sort of intervention into the environment. So I'm imagining, is this a sustainable practice or not really? I mean, you are changing the environment quite a bit, aren't you?
I would say it is a transformative practice. It is sustainable in a sense that some later forms of environmental transformation are not sustainable, in the sense that this does not lead to a long-term deterioration of environmental conditions. That's one of the
really
distinctive things. Yeah.
Okay.
Except through deforestation. So I think that
right.
is the key thing. There is large-scale deforestation that happens as a result of this. But the rice fields in and of themselves, one of the things about rice soil is that soils planted with rice do not deteriorate over time, unlike many other crops, above all wheat, which we know very well, and even more so a crop like sugar. And we'll come to that, I'm sure, later in the story. But in that sense, what you have is a sort of long-lived rice ecosystem, which is a kind of monoculture. But at the same time, it fosters certain kinds of life, much less than a sort of so-called pristine forest ecosystem would have done. But nevertheless, there is an interdependence between rice soils, species of wetland birds, other wetland creatures. There's a very close relationship between rice and silk cultivation in southern China, for example, which leads to a sort of long-term ecology. And in that sense, it's sustainable, but it doesn't come, you know, without massive transformation and indeed loss. And that loss is loss of forest land, but also the loss of the kinds of lifestyles that came from those who did not practice settled agriculture.
Okay, this is maybe a question, an anachronistic question that's coming from somebody who lives today. But why didn't they just go on and on if it was such a massive success? And if they experience this population boom and urban centers development and so forth, how come they were kind of self-contained? Why didn't they just cut out cut out all the woods and keep going? Or did they this is a very naive question, or maybe they encountered the nomadic steppe or something, I don't know.
I think it's far from a naive question. I think it's a very interesting question. And I think the answer is actually...
Yeah.
Is politics. What happens is, of course, that the wealth of southern China is one of the things which attracts what becomes the Mongol Empire. And there is a period of intense and devastating warfare that happens along the course of the Mongol conquests from the steppe, the establishment of the Yuan dynasty. At the heart of the Mongol Empire, this is another place I start, the Burning Earth, is a pretty stark environmental conflict between those Mongol leaders who wanted to basically turn China into grazing land and those who thought, no, I think we need to foster this amazing, productive, settled agriculture that we find here. And the leader of the Yuan dynasty, Kublai Khan, sided with those who wanted to work with what China already was, which was a vast agrarian empire, against his own brother, for example, who believed that a kind of ecological transformation of China to turn it into something more like the steppe was what the Mongol Empire was trying to foster. So there's this battle at the heart. But the other thing I'd say, and the answer to, you know, why does this not just expand infinitely, is the security that this agricultural revolution in China brings is a marginal security. We're not talking about a transformation that liberates farmers from seasons of drought and dearth. We're talking about a margin of safety above bare subsistence, which is transformative. Let's not deny that this is totally transformative in what it is possible for a human life to be. But nevertheless, it's a thin margin. And that margin, when you start to get, for example, significant episodes of unseasonably cold weather, which you have coinciding with the collapse of the Yuan dynasty in the 14th century, there is not the resilience to last more than a few seasons of that.
Okay, you mentioned the Mongols, and I can't get past that. Here's a question one won't hear often when talking about the Mongol history, and that's probably before the time of Kublai Khan. What's the connection between grass and the expansion of the Mongol Empire?
So there's some really fascinating work coming out in climate history now. Niccolo de Cosma and others have shown that, first, let's take a step back and remember that on one estimate, one in four horses in the world was in the Mongol army. One in four horses in the world is estimated to have been serving in the Mongol army. The very essence of Mongol power is that horse-mounted cavalry. And in that sense, grass is the literal root of Mongol power. And what we have evidence of is a period of a succession of wet years on the steppe, coinciding with the rise of Genghis Khan, of the Mongol Empire. And in a very simple material sense, that allowed the grass that the horses grazed on to grow more rapidly than usual. And in a very prosaic but ultimately dramatic sense, sort of enables the sustenance of the horse populations, which then becomes sort of the very heart of the Mongols' military conquest, which stretch all the way from Eastern Europe to China.
So what the grass was functioning as like an express highway in the medieval era, or why is grass so important?
Grass was functioning just exactly like that. Partly horses consume a lot. Partly the steppe does become a highway. I mean, that metaphor is used a lot, the kind of steppe highway that allows for these sort of rapid lightning attacks that the Mongol forces become notorious for. And I think we need to be careful because clearly there is a material relationship between climate, ecology, and the nature of Mongol military power. But this is not a sort of monocausal explanation. There is so much else that is going on to do with the structure of power within the Mongol Empire, to do with the ideologies that legitimize Mongol rule, to do with even the cosmology of the Mongol Empire, which sees divinity embodied in different animals and indeed in the sort of grass steppe itself and sort of wide open skies. So there's cultural factors here. There are there's military technological innovations to do with innovations in weaponry. But yes, some of this is about grass. Some of this is about the steppe. Some of this is about ecology.
Okay, but would it be fair to say that without grass, no Mongol Empire, at least not in the form that did materialize?
Yeah. Yes, I think it would.
Okay. Well, that's freaking mind-blowing. That's crazy. I'm sorry. But yeah, you know, we often hear about Genghis Khan and about the Mongol army and you know, the conquest and all that stuff, but never about the grass.
The grass is important. The grasslands are actually just of fundamental importance in the history of all of Eurasia.
Right. It makes total sense.
It's not just the Mongols. It's all of these mounted invaders from Central Asia who eventually also take power in India, as the Mughal Empire does later on.
Right. If we go back to China, you said that China's wealth, which sprung up from this expanded rice cultivation, began attracting adventurous merchants from elsewhere, particularly Westerners, who were on the hunt for riches. But before we tackle that, I wanted to ask, why would people risk such a dangerous endeavor? Were they that desperate or just greedy or a combination of both? I suppose maybe my question is this: what were the conditions for an average person, an average peasant farmer in medieval Europe like at the time?
So let's take one step back, because long before Europeans arrived in Chinese markets, Arab traders were already there. So if you look at the commerce, the seaborne commerce through the Indian Ocean, there's evidence of trade directly between the Middle East and China going back to the 8th or 9th century of the Common Era. a lot of that is then also going through India, through Southeast Asia, and you have the rise of the Southeast Asian port cities as well. And in some sense, Europeans are very late to the game. And when the Europeans first understand China's riches, it's not through the ocean voyage. Of course, it's initially over land. We think of the famous travelogue of Marco Polo. And of course, many questions have been raised about exactly where he went and exactly how far he traveled. But the point is that it was through texts like that, through these early European travelers who actually traveled through the Mongol Empire.
Which is crazy. How long would that take you? I'm sorry.
Months. I mean, some of these were years long.
Years.
Voyages.
Okay.
I mean, if you look at the famous voyage, not from Europe, but from North Africa of Ibn Battuta, that takes him decades. And he writes, of course, this amazing travelogue of his entire journey through what he saw as the Islamic world, the Dar al-Islam. But Europeans also are starting to write about their experiences. And there is a mixture, of course, of rumor and fantasy and experience that's sort of feeding into this. But one of the really striking things which historians have found is when they looked at the papers, the private papers of the man who had become known as Christopher Columbus, he is annotating these travelogues. Including Marco Polo's, and he's highlighting the mention of riches, of gold, of treasure. And this brings me to the direct question that you asked, Zaza, which is, Europe has, of course, been devastated in the 14th century by the Black Death. And you said you've had guests talking about the Black Death on Smart Cookies, and that's an important part of the story. By decimating the European population, there are ways in which, paradoxically, the Black Death actually empowers ordinary workers in Europe because there's such a shortage of labor.
Yeah, he actually talked about that.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
there is a sense of Europe being isolated from the world, particularly after the fall of the Mongol Empire. And, of course, there is extensive intra-European conflict, which eventually is what leads those on the far western fringes of Europe, the Iberian Peninsula, to start to seek an oceanic route to exactly those riches. And this is a moment where the European elite, the aristocracy, had already come to highly value fine spices, which at this point grew in only a very, very few places in the world. And often they didn't know where that was. My colleague at Yale, Paul Friedman, has wrote a brilliant book called Out of the East. He's a medieval European historian, in which he argues that actually India, the word India in the European imagination, the medieval period, just meant somewhere out there where these amazing delicacies come from, these spices. And it was through travelogues, it was through expanding knowledge of the world, it was through early maps and cartography that something more specific started to sort of emerge in the European imagination as to where these spices might be coming from.
Okay, so we're tilting towards greed more than desperation, I suppose?
I think it becomes greed. I think initially it is a feeling of there being this world out there that might, partly in fantasy, provide all the riches of one's dreams. Partly it's religion. So much of this is bound up with the sort of intensifying conflict between Christianity and Islam in Europe. And those two things are very closely bound up. So when you start to get all these references to gold, partly into that is read biblical references, but partly there is a sense that European kingdoms need that gold in order to be able to fight holy war. And so I think greed plus a religious motivation, a kind of crusading mentality, these all come together, I think, in a kind of uneasy mix. And sometimes they're pulling in different directions, of course, and sometimes they're sort of jointly propelling these adventures.
If you go back to my original question, because I always imagine life in medieval Europe, when I do imagine it, my mind always goes into two opposite but equally dramatic directions. One is, we talked about the complete dystopia of the Black Death, like, you know, Mordor. And the other one is this idyllic peasant life that you can read about maybe in Tolstoy's novels, which was another era, of course, but still pretty much like a feudal system or whatever. So peasants working hard in the fields, but also enjoying the abundant fruits of their labor which they did surrounded by the stunning romantic scenes of nature. It's never something in between. That's why I ask.
I mean, and as with all of these associations that we have, you know, one can probably see elements of truth in each of these images that we construct. But peasant life in every part of the world at this point, of course, yep, was deeply risky, often violent, and deeply precarious.
And that goes for medieval China
medieval Europe, and Mesoamerican societies, right, too.
Right, of course, of course. Professor, what was the difference between wheat and rice cultivation, especially as it pertained to nature, but also in the different ways these two grains shaped societies?
The differences are perhaps more fundamental than we might imagine. And the first scholar to point this out was Francesca Bray, who was writing in the 1980s. Francesca Bray is a wonderful historian and anthropologist, works on China, but then more broadly started to work on rice. And in the 80s, she wrote this really interesting book on the rice economies of Asia, in which she ends, there's a sort of coda to that book, in which she really sort of spells out the difference between rice and wheat and suggests that we often think, of course, about the sort of fundamental divergence between European and Asian societies. And for most of the 20th century, there were a whole lot of assumptions that basically, for want of a better word, culture is what describes and helps to explain these differences. And she suggests, without necessarily disputing that there are cultural differences that emerge, that there's some fundamental properties of the staple crop which might help us to understand different social organizations. And one of the big differences is rice needs more labor to begin with, because water is so important to the rice crop. And so there is something very, very intensive about what it is to build a rice field. And I use the word build quite intentionally, because there's an element of construction involved. The timing is absolutely crucial when it comes to rice, more so than with most other staple crops, of exactly what level of water you need for the crop to flourish. And that takes a lot of artisanal skill. It takes a lot of knowledge. Rice soils tend to be very wet and boggy by definition. And this has tended even to this day to resist mechanization. So that is one big part of the difference. Another part of the difference is that you need to keep much less of a rice crop for seed for future harvests than you do for wheat. In that way, rice is a more efficient crop. But the big differences that we're starting to point towards is that for rice cultivation, it doesn't make sense to continually expand one's land holdings. And actually, this goes back to the earlier question you were asking me, Zaza, perhaps about, you know, why doesn't it just keep going? There isn't necessarily an advantage to a large estate when it comes to rice, because of the kind of labor and skill that it takes, and because there isn't an advantage to mechanization. Whereas with wheat in Europe, what you have is the rise of what we now consider to be a sort of feudal economy. And some of that is about the economies of scale that come with using the moldboard plow, for example, to plow these wheat fields, which make it more effective and more efficient to have larger holdings. You need more of the crop for seed, which again, sort of, there's an impetus to expand one's holdings. So again, without being deterministic, because of course there are so many choices and decisions that individual societies make, and it's not as if all wheat growing or all rice growing societies are the same or have the same institutions. Far from it. And I think we need to attend to those differences. But at some very macro, big picture, broad brush level, I think those differences are certainly interesting and instructive.
I listened to one of your recent interviews, and you said something extremely fascinating. You said that of all the technologies that transform the possibilities of life on Earth, the portable firearm looms larger than we've acknowledged. Wow. Can you unpack that a little bit? Why are guns, if we compare them to, I don't know, bows, such a dramatic invention?
Thank you for bringing that up, Zaza. I think for me, that was the single most unexpected realization that I came to when I was writing this book. That was not an insight that I began with. And the more I was looking into particularly the history of the 19th century, the more I realized that the capacity to inflict destruction that comes from portable firearms, and of course this is both animal killing and human killing, is out of proportion to any other single innovation in technology, in the technology of violence that one had seen up to this point. And I think the place where you really see that just manifest is in the American West. And there are all of these accounts of large parties of hunters with some of the earliest sort of easily portable firearms, many of which were manufactured right here in my home city of New Haven, Connecticut. I'm sort of out of my window as I speak to you. I'm looking at the scene of what was the Eli Whitney Armory and then the Winchester Small Arms Corporation, which John Wayne described as the gun that won the West. Also here in New Haven, Connecticut, Springfield, Massachusetts. And you have these accounts of parties of hunters going on the newly constructed railroads into the West and literally decimating millions and millions of bison.
Those and pictures, course, right, with like skulls, or was it carcasses, mountains of them, and then like one stupid guy standing in front of them with like a rifle or something. It looks absurd. That.
And yet for me, that eventually sort of, I started to see, particularly, you know, we'll talk about this in a minute, perhaps, but as we then look to the 20th century and the argument that I make in the book that actually warfare is a major driver of our planetary crisis, if we want to call it that, I think we need to read that story back to the 19th century and see that just the capacity to cause destruction that the portable firearm gives, as you say, one guy or a small band of people, is a step change. I'm sure of that.
Okay, you mentioned it, so we got to go there. We're obviously skipping past the entire historical epochs, but I really want us to have a chance to talk about the great calamities of the 20th century, namely the two world wars. In school, in textbooks, in popular histories, in documentaries, we always hear about the massive, you know, casualties. We always hear about the atrocities that were committed, naturally, the razed cities, and so forth. However, we never, and I really mean never, hear about the impact a truly planetary war has on the environment.
Yeah, and here too, I think this is something that became more and more important to the Burning Earth as I was doing the research and the writing. Initially, I was going to deal with both of the world wars in half of one chapter. and as you know now, between them, they take a chapter each in about 80 pages of the book. And
yeah. Can we talk about each of them a little bit?
We can talk about each of them separately. Absolutely. First of all, I think we quite rightly and understandably emphasize the colossal human suffering that both of the wars, and particularly the Second World War, perhaps brought. And I think that telling the environmental story is actually not an alternative to that. It's absolutely entwined with the human suffering. And I think that's the point that I want to make, is that both of the wars accelerate this twinned capacity to cause both human suffering and environmental harm. And the First World War, if we start there, it is really the first conflict that has a truly global impact, first and foremost in its search for mineral and other natural resources. And this is clear from the very beginning of the war. This is clear in the minds of planners on both sides, that their tentacles need to reach onto literally every continent in order to make this war, which has been called by Tim Mitchell the first carbon-fueled war, the first major industrial war. Though some would say maybe the American Civil War can be seen as the first major industrial war, but the First World War, in terms of its impact, in terms of where it's drawing its resources from, is truly global. It reaches every continent. We know now that it also reaches every continent in terms of the human conquest, human consequences, particularly in terms of, now we know just how important Asian and African soldiers are to the fighting, even when the fighting has taken place primarily in Europe. But if we expand our perspective further, we can see that in terms of the demand for natural resources, it's a global war. Secondly, I think it has a global imaginative effect, in the sense that it brings to light an unprecedented capacity for human beings to destroy. And I think there's one small example I'll give you that I think captures that. the first year of the war, David Lloyd George, who was at that time the Minister for Munitions, but who goes on to become a Prime Minister of Britain, he gives a speech in which he's trying to describe the war. And all of the metaphors he reaches for are metaphors of natural disasters. He calls it a cyclone, he calls it an earthquake. And it's as if only the power of nature would be enough to capture just how destructive this war was being. Yet by the end of the war, in fact, the order of that metaphor had completely reversed. You have a team of meteorologists working in Bergen in Norway, led by Wilhelm Bjerknes, and they come to understand some of the biggest climatic forces acting. They're studying how mid-latitude cyclones develop. And they change the order of the metaphor. They call them, as we still call them today, weather fronts. And fronts is based on the image of contending armies in the trenches. And so it is as if that by the end of the war, it is no longer the power of nature that gives us a metaphor for how destructive the war is. It's the power of human armies that give us a metaphor for the most powerful possible atmospheric forces. And so I think that's a small but quite revealing example of what the First World War does in this field of ideas. Of course, the dawn of chemical warfare is really important. Peter Sloterdijk, the German philosopher, wrote about this quite a long time ago, suggesting that the use of poison gas at Ypres was a turning point in human life on Earth, because it's a moment where the air itself, the fundamental element which keeps us alive,
is deadly weaponized. Now.
Yeah. Is deadly now. Exactly.
Wow. In the Second World War?
The Second World War, of course, intensifies through its technological innovations, both life-enhancing and life-destroying. And I think that doubleness is what's
life-enhancing.
That
surprised me. I didn't think you would say that.
Life-enhancing and life-destroying. By life-enhancing, I mean all of the innovations in medicine that you start to get. All of the ways in which particularly Allied forces manage to protect their own bodies from the battlefield. I'm talking about DDT, I'm talking about antibiotics, I'm talking about all the technologies which after the war, of course, do find civilian uses to enhance life. And of course, going along with that is a step change in destructive technology. I was very struck by the history, for example, which I relate in that chapter of The Burning Earth of the tank. And even what it was going to be called, they're using all of these different metaphors they use for this petroleum-powered armored vehicle are to do with water. Other options were it was going to be called a cistern, it was going to be called, and eventually they choose a tank. And of course, aerial warfare reaches a completely new level of destructiveness during the war, to the point where there's literally a new kind of weather. The firestorm, which in the last 2 years of the war, Allied bombings make possible. And we reached the final threshold of harm, of course, with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I think that the Second World War plays this troubling double role in both extending the capacity of destruction to the point where literally everything can be annihilated by nuclear weapons, and at the same time creating these technologies, which in particular Allied soldiers are able to use to insulate themselves from the environment. I mean, that's how they started to talk about DDT when the US Army was doing the early trials. The idea that this would make whole environments safe for American troops.
What happens to nature where some of these greatest or most devastating battles were fought? You know, like in the First World War, Verdun at the Somme, or Second World War, Stalingrad, Kursk, I don't know, Dresden. It's like, you know, they always say like nature came back or something. But some of these environments must have been irrevocably changed, right?
Absolutely. There's a wonderful book by Cal Flynn on these sort of landscapes and ruins. And there's a chapter on the battlefields of the First World War in which she shows that many of them are still toxic. Many of them are still damaged. Soil scientists have come up with a whole new word to describe what the First World War does to some of the soils of France and Belgium. They use the word bomb turbation. It's a extension of the phrase pedoturbation, which is just this sort of disturbance of the soil, and bombturbation is the disturbance of the soil on an absolutely epic scale by explosives. And this has a geological impact. Similarly, with some of the battlefields of the Second World War, unexploded bombs are still being found, even in London, certainly in Germany. Very often, my sister lives in Germany, and I get these. She gets these alerts on the Deutsche Bahn app saying, you know, that the train is being paused to find because we found unexploded ordnance. And so the impact is colossal. And I'm really struck by what you said about, you know, nature comes back, because that is an interesting metaphor or line of argument that you get after both world wars. The idea that nature is resilient, that however much human destruction you see, there's perhaps even hope in the idea that nature will grow back. And of course, one sees that all over. One sees scenes of absolute human devastation while flowers are blooming again. But there's also lasting harm. And the lasting harm is both ecological, and of course, the lasting harm is also psychological.
Yeah, there's even a meme. I think it became popular during the pandemic about nature is healing, you know. And then you see some guy in a park reading a book. It's like in an ironic twist. But we do have this sort of Disney image of like, yeah, nature is going to come back no matter what happens. That's just the way it is. And, you know, feeling reassured that after Chernobyl, you know, there's still like doggies running around. You know, forests are coming back and all that stuff, but it's not the same, is it?
It's not the
same. There's YouTube videos of these people coming in with the dosimeter, and it's like still super. I mean, I don't know how dangerous it is, but it's probably not very healthy or good.
And I think we can also see, I mean, there are very different moral lessons we can draw from that idea that nature is coming back. One is nature doesn't care about us. And so there's that whole line of thinking, and there was that book by Alan Weisman, The World Without Us, imagining, you know, okay, we'll disappear, but nature will be fine. And of course, that argument was a very troubling one that one heard during the pandemic, at the same time that there was such mass human suffering and so much inequality in the way that people were experiencing the pandemic. And so I think there's at least a double edge to the way those kinds of arguments are mobilized.
Yeah, I'm from the Balkans originally, and you know, there's this philosopher Slavoj Žižek, and he also has some sort of a train of thought about like nature being one big, we are a part of nature, but nature is one big catastrophe, you know, planets colliding and black holes, and the way we, you know, we kind of use these calamities, like where does oil come from and all of that stuff, we're profiting from it. But nature is, I think he says, pardon my language, that nature is not like a benevolent mother, but a bitch of a mother. Much in what you said, like that it doesn't care about us. So yeah, I don't know.
And I think we turn that around and say, well, those of us who do care about humanity, I mean, how can we sort of think through the fact that actually environmental destruction is part and parcel of human suffering. And that's the way I was sort of trying to tell the stories of the two world wars in the book.
Right. I believe the period after the Second World War is known as the Great Acceleration, right? We're suddenly exponentially increasing our water consumption, carbon emissions rise dramatically. And of course, the human population is booming. And it seems that more than ever, it's all underpinned by our total detachment from nature, let's say, that I kind of opened the conversation with. And since I went to Bible school as a child, I'm not religious anymore, it made me think of the famous passage from Genesis, which goes like this. I'm going to read it. I actually wrote it down. Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth. That seems pretty damning to the predicament that we find ourselves in, doesn't it?
Interestingly, back in the 60s, there was a piece that the medieval historian Lynn White wrote, and it was published in Science. This is in the late 60s. And it was called, you know, On the Origins of Our Ecological Predicament. And White's argument is that Christianity by desacralizing the world and by sort of emphasizing dominion, perhaps from that very passage, plays an important role in our ability to detach ourselves from nature. Now, I think...
I mean, that's the key word in the passage, dominion, isn't it?
Dominion.
Let's be honest.
And I think it's interesting both to sort of recognize the elements of that being true and the fact that, of course, it's more complicated than that. There are multiple Christian traditions, and, you know, looking at it the other way, there was a really interesting critique of White's thesis by Yi Fu Tuan, who's a geographer, who said, well, look, some of the most destructive institutions in medieval China are actually Buddhist monasteries. And so we need to distinguish between, they were agents of mass deforestation. And so we need to distinguish between religious doctrine and behavior. And I think that's right, actually, because I think we don't see a straight line from any one sort of belief system to environmental behavior or abilities to sort of protect. I think, to put it more positively, I think one can find strands of most major religious or spiritual traditions that might either help or harm environmental protection. But at the same time, I think you're also then cherry picking the bits that one wants to sort of see positively or negatively. I think the other thing to say is, well, I'm not sure how much... I think there are multiple ways that great acceleration has been justified and legitimated and made sense of. One of them may well be exactly the kind of idea of kind of we are here to have dominion of the earth. But another, which is very powerful, is, of course, from the global south, the idea of development. The idea of development and progress and freedom that formerly colonized people are now sort of claiming for themselves as their right, as their birthright. And in some ways, these are all pushing in the same direction. They're pushing in the direction of imagining human progress without ecological limits. And of course, some people have the luxury of being able to imagine that more fully than others, which is to say that if you're thinking about working class residents of a city in the global south, then the idea of being above nature or insulated from nature is being challenged every single day. And then for those with more privilege in the global north, but also within the elites of the global south, I think that's a different set of imaginaries that emerge of really kind of insulating ourselves from natural limits.
Yeah, go to the supermarket, you have steak, you have veggies, everything's neatly packaged. Here in Japan, everything's wrapped into plastic. So it's like it even emphasizes more that this is a product, you know, not completely detached from its origins and stuff. And I think about this recently. Not that I'm far from an environmentalist, don't get me wrong. Far from it. But we rarely think about where is this all coming from? How is it being sustained?
And you know,
it's weighing on me, I have to be honest, a little bit recently.
You're in Japan, Zaza. I grew up in Singapore. A technology like air conditioning is such an interesting index of this idea that some urban residents have of being able to, in a sense, insulate themselves from even the climate. Like you control the climate. And that's very true in the US. In the US, I think on one estimate, something like 80% of American homes already had air conditioning by the end of the 1970s. And so there really is that sense that we control our environments in a very literal sense.
Okay, thus we arrive at the present moment, which is marked not by one, but by many pretty devastating, if interconnected, crises. Of course, there's the climate breakdown, but there's also deforestation, loss of biodiversity, pollution, ocean acidity, microplastics infestation, apparently found in clouds also recently. Apparently, we're breathing them out now as well. Pretty scary stuff. Professor, this is truly not just my Eastern European melancholy speaking, but it doesn't look all that good out there, does it?
Just to add to the gloom, I think actually
great,
that there is no even while we deal with these scary new risks and threats, some of the older ones have not gone away, like warfare, racial discrimination, all of the ways in which human beings have harmed each other are now intersecting with this expanding scale of environmental harm. And I think they sort of feed on each other in interesting ways. I think if we take a big picture, we are facing an alarming future, and that's to put it mildly. And yet we all have to function. And I think the way that we all make sense of how to be and how to act is not at that level of the planet, perhaps, but at the level of our own communities, including the communities we choose to be a part of as citizens, as political agents. And I think for me, writing this book, which in some sense is detailing a lot of suffering, a lot of harm, I did find I had to keep shifting scale from that sort of global and planetary scale to the scale at which one can see more cause for hope, one piece at a time, in terms of ways in which there are successes that one can attribute to the global
Professor
environmental
Noel,
movement.
Please don't give me this, like, one guy planted a couple of trees, so we can be hopeful for the future. I can't take, my heart is going to give in if I hear one of those.
No, that's not what I'm offering
okay.
you, Zaza.
Okay, I'm
what
sorry.
I'm offering you is that the one guy planting the trees it matters to that guy.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting
I'm not slagging
that
off the guy. He's an amazing guy or girl.
I'm not suggesting that is going to save us.
Yeah.
I'm suggesting that it matters to that guy and that is the paradox that we have to deal with.
Okay. Fair enough. Now, as a Balkan commie, I have to be honest, I always fall back on the famous line from Chico Mendes, who said, ecology without class struggle is gardening. I mean, can we truly even begin to address any of this with more or with different so-called green consumption? Any of the predicaments that we're facing?
It's a great quote, and I do spend some time talking about Chico Mendes's movement in my in The Burning Earth. And what is really interesting is that the specifically environmental dimension actually comes very late into Chico Mendes's political life. He's a labor organizer.
Yeah.
And first and foremost, and to the very end of his life, I think that is what he prioritized. And even after his assassination, some of his allies were pointing out that fundamental difference between environment as a sort of luxury concern of global north, where environment is about protecting ecosystems from people, and a sense that environmental protection without thinking about livelihoods and work and social justice is never going to mean anything to most people alive in the world. I agree with that profoundly. I am quite influenced by a book by the Canadian political scientist Peter Dauvergne. It's called The Environmentalism of the Rich. And it's a really interesting perspective on just what you were saying, more green consumption, greenwashing, lots of that going on. I think without fundamental changes in how we live, EVs are not going to solve our predicament. Don't get me wrong. The rollout of EVs will be good for the air we breathe. But the amount of resource that goes into that kind of production, whether it's rare earths, whether it's water consumption, I think we have to take the bigger view, which you've just put on the table.
Yeah, it's awesome to see how, especially in the global north, people are all of a sudden rediscovering trains. You know, like, why haven't we done this all along? Like, what if we had a system where a bunch of us could go in a single car and drive somewhere without the exhaust pipes? And people are like, before I start ranting, let me ask you something else. Recently, there's been a lot of debates about personal carbon footprints. It always makes maybe this is not a good route for me, but it makes my blood boil a little bit, because while we're arguing if I can go see my mom who lives on a different continent, a billionaire's carbon footprint is reportedly that of a million people. That's not my number. A million. So instead of starting this discussion with paper straws, shouldn't we maybe begin with private planes, mega yachts, and privately owned castles before we begin it in earnest?
I couldn't agree more. As we know, this idea of the personal carbon footprint was popularized by BP in the 1990s as a way to sort of divert attention to individualized consumption, around which, of course, there's sort of grown a moralistic discourse in certain parts of the world about we should do this or do that, while, as you say, the sort of private jets, that there was an interesting piece in I think it was published in either Science or Nature recently, about how both the rich and the poor vastly underestimate the carbon impact of the rich, which is to say that if you ask poorer people, and this included surveys done in India and Nigeria, if you ask poorer people how much more than them do they think that the rich consume, they underestimate. And of course, the rich underestimate their consumption as well. So I think that there is a level of, at this point about going to visit your mother, I mean, that's not a trivial thing. I mean, I think one of the outcomes of the global history of the last 200 years is that many of us have families scattered all over the world. That is, in a sense, part of the history that has brought the world to the place that we are. And so I think that very specifically narrow focus on individual consumption is not going to get us very far. Plus, it won't work politically. So I think that is absolutely right to think about, well, what's really driving this? What's really driving this? And I think that sort of disproportionate impact of a very, very small number of people on whether it's emissions or it's water use or it's pollution is something we need to pay plenty of attention to.
And when it comes to transforming the environment, there's a whole new player in town. Maybe it's been here for a while, but it's becoming more prominent as the climate breakdown becomes worse and worse. So that's geoengineering, of course. There's lots of like pretty crazy science fiction ideas floating out there. I don't know, injecting aerosols into the stratosphere. One was about bleaching ice or something, something like that, about reflecting light back into the universe. What do you think of this concept in general? I mean, that must be the apotheosis, like, of this entire idea that features prominently throughout your book.
It is the apotheosis of the kind of conquest of nature idea. It is, let us extend this as far as it will go, and we treat the Earth's climate as a thermostat that we can control. And they use that language. You and I may think of these as science fiction ideas. One of the things that I'm aware of and that I do find concerning is how quickly they have gained traction, how close we are, I think, to some of these ideas being implemented. And one of the stories that's told, which I don't think is quite right, is that this is an agenda of the global north that is being imposed upon the rest of the world. I think it's more complicated than that. In fact, I think that one of the big concerns in the global south is actually not that these technologies will be used, but that they will not have access to them, that they will be used unilaterally, that the debates about whether we should use them, the ethical and practical debates, are being had behind closed doors with a very, very small number of people. One institution, Harvard University, and MIT, two institutions in the greater Boston area, I think account for a significant proportion of all the research that's being done in this area. And so there is a real question about under whose terms and on what conditions this will be done. There are a lot of concerns in an increasingly divided world about the unilateral use of these technologies. These technologies are certainly being developed at speed in China as well at the same time. And there are real concerns about the impacts that the unilateral use of geoengineering technologies will have, of course, on neighboring countries. And I am not optimistic about any prospect for sort of international agreements on their use, not at this moment, not at the way these technologies are being developed. And so my sense is that I think it is very likely these technologies are going to be deployed. As a historian, I worry profoundly about their assumptions, about the consequences that they are bound to have, which are outside the plan, so to speak. And most of all, perhaps about, you know, whose voices are at the table when we're actually making these decisions.
I mean, that's literally the plot of the movie Matrix. We try to black out the sun to defeat the robots. Now we have eternal darkness. Scary stuff.
We're on our way there in terms of these technologies. I'm fairly convinced of that.
Yikes. Speaking of which, what's your favorite, maybe like dystopian film? Or a work of art?
This is a great question. So what is it called? Is it called
in a scenario where we don't make it? You know what I mean?
When we don't make it.
Yeah. At least not in the way we would have hoped.
So there's a brilliant novel by the Indian novelist Prayag Akbar called Layla, which is a powerful dystopian novel about the privatization of everything, including water.
I'm sorry, but that doesn't sound so far-fetched from where I'm sitting.
It's the extension of that to its furthest possible extremes. I can't recommend it highly enough.
All right, perfect. Okay, Professor, despite all of the destruction and tragedy you detail in the book, you said that writing actually gave you a bit of hope. We touched on that before with the person planting trees. Since hope is in short order these days, could you offer us some, please?
I think for me, the most hopeful thing about writing the book was we can take for granted. So you said earlier, Zaza, you're not an environmentalist. Well, I was not an environmentalist to begin with. I grew up in a high-rise Asian city, and I was absolutely convinced, even when I first became a professional historian, that environmental concerns were at best secondary to concerns that I had to do with social justice and political freedoms. And so I think it's easy to take for granted, in a way, just how quickly the environmental movement has become a multifaceted thing, which is not about separating the environment as a concern from concerns about social justice. And so for me, the most hopeful aspect of writing the book is really the movement for what we now think of as environmental justice or climate justice. That movement has you know, mountains to climb and formidable obstacles in its way. But it is a movement that I do think probably mobilizes more energy and attention than any other. And I think what's hopeful about it is that it's not separating those things. It is actually bringing them together. And it is showing that the way we got to this planetary crisis is completely bound up with the way in which we have sort of ended up with such a divided and unequal world, and that the solution to both of those things actually lies in bringing them together.
Last question, Professor. You said something really interesting at the beginning of one of your lectures that I listened to. You visited Bangkok, I believe, a couple of times, and it was after the floods, and the floods became more and more common as they do. As the climate crisis progresses. And you said that you were struck by how sort of normal life just came back quickly, and that you were not sure whether that was resilience or whether that was us just ignoring the problem and carrying on. As it stands right now, which one is it? And I'm not just talking about Bangkok. I'm talking about all of us right now.
This is the paradox, though, isn't it? So I Bangkok is a city I know well, and I was referring to the first trip I made after the catastrophic floods of 2011. And I was there about 3 months later. And there was very little visible sign left that the floods had ever happened. Like, life went on. And I just found this disconnect between the city I was experiencing, which was a vibrant, unequal city, mega city, like so many other mega cities, and all of these things I was reading that, you know, 50% of the city is going to be underwater by 2050. And we all read these things all the time. We hear this about many of them Asian cities. We hear this about Saigon. We hear it about Miami. And I think no doubt there is a level of blindness that we have to adopt in order to continue inhabiting these cities. But I think there's a deeper point, which is that I am unconvinced by projections that, you know, we're all going to move to northerly latitudes. No, that's not how this is going to play out. These cities are not going anywhere. Life may well become more difficult in these cities as a result of rising sea levels, as a result of more intensive storms. But the idea of retreat, which one often hears in certain environmental and policy circles, I think that's a fantasy. And I think that the way that the climate crisis plays out is going to play out in the places we know. I'm not sure resilience is the right word necessarily to describe that, but I think a kind of realistic perspective that we need to understand bit by bit how these cities are going to change is perhaps more what I was trying to get at with that.
I asked that because my home country of Slovenia faced some devastating floods last year. It was the first time. I'm almost 40 years old, but it never happened before, not to that extent. And all the scientists said it was, of course, exacerbated by the climate crisis. And it's going to keep getting worse and worse. But we kind of fixed everything, and now we're just carrying on. And there's not much discussion about any of the causes anymore. Life has just like returned, like you said, and that's pretty much it. And it is depressing in some weird, very specific way to observe all of this. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. I think there's sort of two levels of denial. On the one hand, there's the sort of straightforward denial of the existence of climate change that's sort of taken over the United States of America. That's
a bit widespread. Extreme.
That's extreme, and that's not so widespread in other parts of the world. But there's another kind of denial, which I think every society has some level of when it comes to this, which is that the floods come and the floods come again, and the floods, which haven't come before, are coming more and more often. And we reckon with it for a short amount of time, and then we continue. That level of denial, I think, is fairly universal. And perhaps that is just baked into the way we live now and the way we think. But I think it's worth distinguishing between that and the very extreme kind of climate change denial that has sort of run rampant over here on the side of the Atlantic.
Well, I mean, that begs the question, how bad does it have to get in order for us to attempt some sort of actually transformative change?
And for whom? I mean, for me, that's the fundamental question at the heart of the burning earth. For whom? Because I think that in so far as those with wealth and power can retreat, whether to second or third homes or sort of further elevations, this idea that climate change will affect all of us is, I think, both true and not exactly true. Yes, it will. All of us who are alive on this earth are going to be affected by more extreme storms, by changing patterns of weather, by rising sea levels. But there's a very, very different capacity that different groups of people have to insulate themselves. And that's a word that I've been thinking about a lot. And until it reaches a point where those with wealth and power are no longer able to do that, I think that's why we keep going. That's why we keep going, because it's usually those with less political power and less voice who are going to be the first to be affected. And that's certainly been true up to now.
I know I said last question 8 questions ago, but this truly is the last question. As a historian, Professor, do you think that humans can learn from history?
I do, but I don't think that lessons from history are necessarily a good guide to the future. I think that lessons from history are important for our understanding of our institutions. They're important for our understanding of how we see the possibilities before us. I mean, it is as a legacy of history that certain options are thinkable and certain options are not. I think we can learn from history up to that point. What I don't think we can do is say, well, oh, this moment is like that moment in the 1930s or the 1940s, and we can learn from what decisions people made then to sort of guide us now. No, I think that what we can learn from history is to learn both how we can open and how we have limited our imaginations as to sort of what futures might look like. But then those futures are ours to make. And I don't think the answers to that lie in the past at all.
Okay, we did end up on a sort of a hopeful note there. thank you so much, Professor Amrith. Where can people find The Burning Earth? Find bookstores everywhere, I suppose.
Absolutely.
All right.
Thank you so much, Azza. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
A pleasure is all mine. Do you maybe have any social media where people can follow your work? Or no?
At @Amrith_historian on Instagram.
Okay, perfect. All right. Thank you. Thanks again. And I hope we can do this again in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I've been told on countless YouTube tutorials that I have to say this, otherwise nothing happens, which is strange. Also, if you feel like it, support me on Patreon. I'm playing the world's smallest violin here, but this is a one-person pod. I have no production team, no nothing. So feel free to hop on Patreon and find smart cookies on there. And the last, but certainly not least, I have to thank my existing patrons, Tovarishin, Tovarishitsa. Without you, this podcast simply would not exist. So thank you so much. That makes you actual producers of this show. So eternal thanks to Darey, Roktorjan, Sasha Vipotnik, Nevin Svijanovic, Yush Premro, Nate Sirk, Goran Ivašić, Anže Sever, Ole, Marin Ferrara, Aljaš Maher, Štrole, Ajda Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinjo, Goran, Gordon, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen, Veronika, and Taichi. You guys rock. Thank you so much.